You're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me as always is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how is it going this week?
It's going pretty well this week, Chris. It's actually kind of slow, not too much going on. I'm going away for the weekend, though, with some guys on a kind of a retreat to get away, so I'm looking forward to that, but otherwise, not a bad week. How about yourself?
Yeah, it's been quite a busy week for me here. There have been so many things going on, and I wish I had more time to read, but I did manage to get some comic reading in. Speaking of which, we've gotten a pretty good response to last week's show, where instead of interviews, we actually talked about comics the whole time. And I think people enjoyed our speculation, anyway, on where things might be leading into the next movie, although I kind of have a feeling that we may be wrong, but we'll find out in the coming months.
That is pretty true. I mean, with these comics, and I think even just with the movie itself, there's a lot that we don't know. You know, JJ's really good at keeping things quiet and, you know, behind closed doors. And so I think we're all going to be surprised, honestly, once the movie finally comes out. But yeah, I do think that this comic is going to give us some background information that we have been hoping for. So we'll see.
Well, we'll see. Until then, let's jump into some book news this week. And the first story that we have up here is related to David R. George III's Allegiance in Exile. And he was recently talking about this to StarTrek.com.
I was really excited to see this. You know, the book just came out this last week on Tuesday, and so he was just talking about this is a really fun story to be doing. It takes place during the final year of the Enterprise's first five-year mission under Kirk, and Kirk just being in command and finding that this is actually going to be his fourth anniversary as captain. And so seeing that time period for Kirk and what's going on, but I was really actually excited to see this, that actually Lieutenant Sulu is going to be playing a large role in this book. I don't want to spoil anything, but this was on StarTrek.com. I thought it was pretty interesting, and so I'm just hoping that sometime Sulu will say something like, "Oh my, Captain."
I'm sure he will, and it'll be wonderful the way it's written out in the book with all the extra O's and the extra Y's.
Exactly. I mean, it's how it has to be.
Maybe they could use the same chip that they're using in Federation the first 150 years to enhance this novel.
You know, I was thinking that, you know, I can't understand why you wouldn't have George Takei record an "Oh my," because, I mean, well, it's George Takei, and that's just a that's just what you want to hear these days from Sulu somehow. And so maybe we'll even hear it in the new JJ movie. Who knows?
Yeah, you really need that. Now, the storyline of this book was alluded to somewhat in the motion picture and in the novelization by Gene Roddenberry. So I'm looking forward to seeing how this all plays out. I don't have my hands on this book quite yet, but I'll be picking it up on my Kindle.
Yeah, I have it on my iPad, ready to read it. I just finished up another book this afternoon, so I can get to this now, and I'm really excited to be doing that. And it's been a while since I've actually visited the 23rd century and Kirk's Enterprise in this kind of time period, so I think it'll be fun. There's a lot of books coming out in this time period in this upcoming year, and so it'll be kind of a nice return to some old friends, I think.
It definitely will be. And in the interview, George also mentions the first book of the Fall miniseries that he's going to be penning, which takes us back to Deep Space Nine. And that won't come out until September, but I'm always looking forward to any new stories about Deep Space Nine. So if anyone's interested in reading the entire interview, you can go over to StarTrek.com and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Now, another thing that I'm interested in, Matthew, that doesn't get enough attention really is Enterprise. And a Trek movie did an interview with Christopher L. Bennett recently, and he talked a little bit about a new Enterprise book.
Yeah, his new book is called Rise of the Federation, which has been announced as a novel, and it's going to be taking place in that time period after the Romulan War and just really the beginnings of the Federation. And during this time period, too, we know the Enterprise is decommissioned because it was heavily damaged in the battle, gets turned into a museum. And so it's going to be a very interesting thing because the crew, it seems like it's going to be partitioned off into different crews. You know, it's that they're not all going to be together anymore. We do know later on that Archer becomes Federation president and things like this. So really hoping that as Chris works through this time period, he's going to get to write several books here. But his first one will be out in July. And he did this great interview with them. And I don't really want to give away too much of it, but honestly, it sounds fascinating. And from anybody who knows Chris's work, he's done a lot in kind of this forgotten history era, whether it's Ex Machina and the motion picture era or the buried age with Picard and his era between the Stargazer and being the captain of the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So these kind of areas, he has a lot of familiarity with. And what really excited me in this interview, and I do want to mention, is that he said that he rewatched the entire series and he found a lot of things in there that he was really liking. So this is really encouraging to me because I think you might agree with me. You know, rewatching this series now, I find I love Enterprise more and more every time I see it. So I'm really excited that he's feeling that way and that they've given him this opportunity to explore this, really, this strange new world. We've never really been in this part of the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, I liked Enterprise when it was first on, but I will admit that I do like it even more when I watch it now. And I think a lot of other people feel the same way. I am starting to see a bit more love online for Enterprise. As I always say, I think that that show needed time. I mean, it needed separation in time for people to stop thinking of it as the next Star Trek series. And they wanted to continue on TNG, DS9, Voyager. They wanted to continue to live in that 24th century world. And instead they got Enterprise and they kind of tuned out. I think now, you know, 10 years later, and with it being available on Netflix, we have it here in Japan on Hulu as well. We have it in HD, which is quite nice, even before the Blu-rays come out. People can revisit it just as a TV series and as a Star Trek series, and I think people are starting to love it a lot more. Now, the thing that does disappoint me is that we never really got to see that birth of the Federation, and I'm really glad that Christopher Bennett is exploring that in these new books. The Romulan War, of course, has been dealt with. And then the Rise of the Federation here, definitely parts of the story that I'd like to see filled in. And had the show gone 7 seasons, this is the kind of stuff that I think we would have gotten to see on the screen.
Well, and I think this is one of the things that honestly would have made for a great Enterprise movie. Just these are the kind of stories that are just big and massive in the Star Trek universe, never been touched. And this is the kind of thing I think a lot of us would have liked to see, but very glad that Pocket Books has decided to really explore this part of the universe, this time period, and really fill in this gap. I mean, this is one of the things that the books do well. We heard this talking to Keith DeCandido and some of the other authors really talking about how the books can fill in those time period gaps and give us that piece of history that makes things make more sense. And I think this is one of the best parts of the literary universe.
Yeah, this is also good news because about a year ago, maybe a bit more than a year ago, there was a lot of concern amongst Enterprise fans that Pocket Books was abandoning Enterprise in the literary world. In fact, one of our writers, Shanna, wrote a piece that's on Trek FM that expressing concern about the fact that word from Pocketbook seemed to be that Enterprise was kind of being put to rest. So this is wonderful to see. Great to see this revival.
Well, and it's true. I had the same reservations when I saw that they had taken the Romulan War book series, which was supposed to be a trilogy, and turned it into two books.
Yeah.
The end of the trilogy, or the duology, excuse me, was good. But you could tell that they had had a lot more that they had wanted to do, and it just was not the same. And so I am very thankful that Pocket has done this. And I think, honestly, it can only be helped that Enterprise is going to be released on Blu-ray, which I'm super excited about. And I think that that is really going to help the book sales as people get to find Enterprise all over again. And so I think that this is definitely something that Pocket can capitalize on. And so I'm glad that they will be getting this out to us in July.
Most definitely. I've already pre-ordered my Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays, by the way.
I haven't yet, but I have a gift card to Best Buy, so I'm just going to be getting it in that way when it comes out. But I'm saving that bad boy.
Hopefully the price will come down. Yeah, they came out first at... Well, they're listing for $119, and then Amazon had it for $85, and I just pre-ordered it anyway. I thought, you know, the price is going to come down. I'm not going to actually pay $85. It's already come down to $77, so I'm hoping that it's going to get down to, like, maybe $59 by release time, so people can, you know, really pick that up.
Yes, I totally agree. You know, this will actually be the first Star Trek Blu-rays I own, except for the Next Generation films. I haven't bought any of the other Star Trek Blu-rays yet. And so, but I saw Enterprise coming out, and I thought, I have to have this on Blu-ray. So
it's going to be nice. I'm looking forward to the extras as well, because there's a lot of background about that show that, you know, we don't know that I'd love to see filled in.
And it does seem like they're going to actually be giving us some Blu-ray extras and DVD extras that are completely worth it. And so I'm very excited.
Some new stuff, right, that we don't have on the existing DVDs. That'll be great. Well, let's jump over. We have a very short news segment today. Let's jump over into comics for just a moment and talk about Countdown to Darkness again, which we did a lot last week. But what we're going to talk about today is actually an interview that was done with Roberto Orsi and Mike Johnson, where they talked about the process of doing the series and the types of things that having this little comic miniseries enables them to do that they wouldn't otherwise be able to.
Well, I loved this interview because, one, they just talked about the value of rediscovering comics and the way that they can really help any kind of film or just as an art form. You know, comics are really, I think, in resurgence right now. And the fact that, you know, getting them on the New York Times bestseller list as a Star Trek comic was huge. And so one of the neat things about this is that they talked about in this interview, you know, Countdown really had to do what Generations did, which was pass the baton from the Prime Universe to this new JJ universe. And they had to really deal with that. In fact, most of the comic actually takes place in the Prime Universe. And so now they get an opportunity to start in the JJ universe and stay in that universe and just really set us up for the film in that universe with those characters. And I think that that's what's making this really exciting. And as we talked about last week, we had a huge response just between the both of us and what we thought about the comic.
Exactly. And like you said, Countdown, which led into the 2009 movie, took place almost entirely in the Prime Universe. And in this interview, Mike Johnson says that in this one, rather than showing the backstory, since 2009 established everything on screen, this time in Countdown to Darkness, they're able to show the backstory, and he says they are really setting the table for the next movie here in ways that the original Countdown couldn't. because we hadn't met the new Kirk and Spock yet. And he says the scope is as big as the last series, but this one is full of things we haven't seen yet in the new timeline, all leading into the mind-blowing events of the next movie.
One of the interesting things that Johnson said was that there are no prime connections in this one. The priority, they said, is exploring the new reality. So I'm wondering if they mean prime connections in the sense that there won't be any crossover whatsoever, or that that's just not a focus. And so what we had talked about last week, it made me wonder if we're off, which obviously we can be, or if it's more the fact that this just isn't going to be front and center the way it was last time.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking when I read this. And he made that comment because we did speculate last week about the character who appears in number one and whether there was a Prime Universe connection there or not. What I find really interesting, though, and I'm not going to tell you who the character is here, just in case, you know, you skipped over that discussion last week, so I'm not going to spoil it for you. What I did find interesting, though, is they asked him, will we meet any new characters that show up in the film? And Mike Johnson said, we can't answer without giving anything away, but I can tease you by saying that a character we have not seen yet in the new timeline shows up in issue number one and plays a critical role in the story. And we speculated on whether that character is going to play a big role in the movie or whether that was just kind of a little twist they're throwing in. So it sounds like could actually be a big part of this.
And I think if that's the case, I'm going to be very excited. Obviously, we talked about last week, the twist at the end left us both honestly kind of giddy with anticipation of what that character might mean for the rest of the comic series and even the movie. So I think this is a great start. And if that's the character that we see, I'm very excited.
Definitely. So if you're listening to this and you have not yet picked up Countdown number one, go do it now. It's a great story. I think you'll be really impressed. And if you are an old-time Trekkie like us, like Matthew just said, probably a bit giddy when you turn to that last page. Okay, Matthew, last item before we jump into our feature interview today with David A. Goodman, as we talk to him about his book Federation, The First 150 Years. Still in the comic universe, still in ongoing, the Abramsverse timeline, we had a shipping delay, which we've been having now for about 2 months with IDW, on ongoing number 17. It's finally going to come out next Wednesday, February 6th. And I think you're especially looking forward to this one.
This is one that I am really looking forward to, as they're doing Countdown into Darkness with the ongoing series. They're doing kind of backstories for our main characters. And this one is going to focus solely on Bones. Very excited. Is anyone who's listened to us knows that Bones was my favorite character in the ongoing series. He's my favorite character in the 09 series movie. I think that this is going to be a great comic. I'm hoping we really do get that backstory of, you know, maybe what went wrong or who Bones was married to, all those kind of things. And so I think that this is going to be a really good comic. And so I was a little disappointed that it didn't come out today, which is the 30th when we're recording. But it will be out next week, and we will talk about it then. So I'm very excited to be doing that. Today, we're very excited to have author David A. Goodman with us, author of Federation, The First 150 Years. And honestly, one of the first big books that we've had in a long time about the background of Star Trek's history in the Star Trek timeline. So we're very excited to have David with you. How are you doing tonight, David?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. I'm so glad that you could carve out the time for us, because when I first saw this book advertised on Amazon, I thought, this is such a great idea. And then, of course, I saw the pictures for it, and I just knew I had to get this and read it. Very much enjoyed the book. I honestly hope that this leads to more Star Trek books like this, because this is fantastic.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. I, you know, when honestly, I wish I could take credit for the idea. It was not my idea. It was CBS Consumer Products pitched me the idea. And honestly, I think I had a very similar reaction that you had seeing it advertised, because when they pitched me the idea of doing this book, I was like, oh my God, you really want to do that book? I was so excited that they wanted to do this kind of fictional history, which I am such a fan of, in both in Star Trek and in other properties, that I was just really excited. I mean, I was really honestly kind of dumbfounded that they asked me to do it. Although I have a long writing career in television, I have never written a book before. This is my first book, and I really fully expected somebody would at some point ask the question, wait, have you written a book before? And no one did. And I asked, because I thought, or they knew I hadn't written a book, and it didn't stop them from hiring me. So I was very happy to do this project.
Well, that I am glad of. Well, one of the things I always like to know, especially from the authors and people involved in Star Trek, what was your first introduction to Star Trek?
You know, it's hard to exactly remember. I was in elementary school, and it was on reruns when I was a kid. And when I was a little kid, my images of it were that it was a show that was too scary for me to watch. I mean, I think I saw a piece of the Gorn episode, Arena, when I was very little. It looked too scary. There's a monster. I can't watch it. And then somewhere around fifth or sixth grade, I started watching it. And it was on every night, 6 o'clock in New York, Channel 11. And I became hooked into watching the reruns. And then in junior high, I met a friend. His name was Marty Wagner. And Marty was a much bigger Star Trek fan than I was. And he kind of introduced me to the idea of fandom, the idea of watching every episode of a series. And because the only way to do it then was to just watch it every night and hope that you would catch the episodes that you missed. And then sort of learning the order of episodes, that there was a first season and a second season and a third season. These were things that were not common knowledge when you were a TV watcher in those days. But the idea of fandom of a television show, that was really new, and Star Trek to some extent I think created it. It created TV fandom. I think that and so that was my instruction, was this friend who was sort of opening my mind to the fact that these things were written, and that they were written by science fiction authors, and I really got into it that way. And then suddenly really I had enjoyed the show, but then really got into the details of it, and what are the details of this world. And they did such an amazing job of creating the world of Star Trek that it appealed. That's, I think, what sort of drew me in, aside from the sort of action-adventure stories of the original series, which were always fun to watch back then.
I'm with you like that. I also was raised on the rerun. And my friends actually introduced me just one day. We were at home and, you know, they flipped on the TV and you have to watch this show, Star Trek. And my first episode was Plato's Stepchildren. So not even a good one, but, no. Yeah, I was hooked, you know, from that moment. So, I completely understand, how you feel about that. And, well, one of the things too, what then, you know, you started on the original series. Is that still your favorite series of all of the five, or do you have a different favorite series?
I have different. For me, I love it all, and I really do. Obviously, I feel like all the series have good episodes and bad episodes. I wrote a joke in a Futurama episode that sort of sums up how I feel about Star Trek in terms of it's like, you know, the main character is talking about trying to remind somebody of Star Trek and saying, you know, Star Trek, original series, 79 episodes, about 30 good ones. And that's kind of how I feel about all the series, is that, you know, they're not all perfect, but there's like really good things in each of them. Original series, I'm enjoying again because I love the remastering they've done and the new effects, and you can really enjoy that. It was probably, if I had to pick a favorite, I'd probably say original series, but I, you know, you really, it's a hard choice. I really do watch all of them over and over. I'm a bit of an addict, and I can watch any Star Trek and enjoy it. So.
Well, that, I think, makes you the perfect person to put together this book, having that that depth of knowledge of all the different series, and of course, starting from the original series, for sure.
Well, thanks. Yeah, no, that was it, having that. I mean, everyone said when I was writing the book, "Oh, you must have watched every episode over again," and I'm like, "No, I didn't need to do that because I've been watching every episode for the last 40 years over and over again." So there's a way.
Right.
When I sat down to write the book, I really didn't need to like refresh my memory. It was all right there in front of my head.
Well, you did get to write the Futurama Star Trek episode there. So tell me just a little bit about that, because that's a really funny episode.
Thank you very much. I was hired on Futurama. I was at that time in my career, I had worked actually on Family Guy, and Family Guy was canceled. It would come back a few years later. And after Family Guy was the first animated comedy that I worked on, and it was produced by the same company that produced Futurama, and there were people who recommended me from Family Guy to David Cohen over at Futurama, and he hired me, and this was for what was the fourth season of Futurama. And when I got there, they had been talking about doing an episode with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. It was not necessarily going to be a Star Trek homage. They had a kind of a big, funny Futurama idea of a giant Shatner and giant Nimoy battling over New York. I don't know what more they had, but that hearing that was funny to me. And then as we were tossing the idea around, I sort of, not forcefully, but was emphatically suggested that, you know, this is an opportunity to do a Star Trek episode and try to reunite more than just Shatner and Nimoy, who I felt if you could get them, you could probably get the others. And David Cohen wanted to sort of toss around ideas. He didn't want to decide to do that until we knew we had a really good idea for the episode, and we started tossing around the idea, and we came up with the idea of the gas creature who kidnaps the original series and pits them in a battle with the Futurama characters like a Star Trek episode. And that was my idea, and that's the then also being on the staff of Futurama, it was a very smart staff, really talented comedy writers, all of them Star Trek fans. And yet, I had been there 3 or 4 weeks, and David Cohen said, "Well, it's clear David Goodman's the biggest Star Trek fan, so he should write this." So even in that group, even in that austere, group, I was still the biggest Star Trek fan, and I was assigned that script. We worked out the story together, and then I went off to write the script. I had 2 weeks to write my first draft. The first week I had jury duty, during which I read a Star Trek book, which I never read, John Ford's The Final Reflection, and I was reading that during my lunch breaks, during jury duty. And then jury duty ended, and I thought, oh, great, now I can really focus on the script, because I'd only been writing it at night. And the day after jury duty ended, I sprained my ankle. So then I was up in bed, propped up in bed writing the script, and even with jury duty and the sprained ankle, it was one of the greatest writing experiences to get to write that episode, which I'm very proud of. A lot of great Star Trek references in that episode that don't get in the way of the story, of the comedy, of Futurama. But if you're a Star Trek fan, there's lots and lots of Easter eggs in there for you.
That for me would be like the ultimate job, really, to be able to write comedy, but to put the Star Trek in there. That's awesome.
No, it definitely was a bit of a high point.
Well, you did get to work on the second season of Star Trek Enterprise as a writer and the third as well. So tell me about working on Enterprise, and how did that come about? How did you get that job? You've obviously worked in TV a lot. And so how did it come about that you got to actually work on one of these series?
Yeah, well, you know, when I started to be a writer, back in the 80s when I was trying to, honestly, I had been inspired to be a Star Trek writer, but there really, when I first was trying to break in, there was no Star Trek. This was before Next Generation, or I started to try before Next Generation. And I had a partner, a writing partner, and we were trying to write comedy, and we broke in as comedy writers. And he and I were partners for a long time, and then we split up. And I had always had in the back of my mind, I still would like to write for Star Trek. And over the years, I pitched freelance episodes and never sold anything to every sequel series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager. I'd gone in and pitched every year trying to sell an episode ideas and pitched to every writer who worked there. I pitched to Ron Moore and Ira Bear and Robert Wolf, who became a friend of mine, and Renee Echevarria, Jerry Taylor, I mean, you know, Brannon Braga a couple of times. Like, so I pitched to these people, you know, these were people who were doing work that I really admired. I loved those shows, and I loved the work they were doing, and I'd always wanted to write for those shows. But my main work was in comedy, and my main resume was in comedy. And then I did the Futurama episode, and at that time in the television business, there were less comedy jobs. So it was after Futurama was canceled, and it was canceled the season I worked on it, just like Family Guy, just like about 15 shows that I've worked on were canceled when I worked on them. that there were no, I was looking for a job, and there weren't a lot of comedy jobs. And I just sort of said to my agent, why don't we try, actually, this is a story I don't always tell. At the time, Firefly was in development, and I had a couple of contacts that got me a meeting with Joss Whedon. And I knew that Joss had himself come out of comedy, and I knew that his shows had a lot of comedy in them, and I thought this would be potentially a job that I could get. And I had the meeting with Joss, and he didn't offer me the job. It went very well, and I'm a huge Firefly fan, became a huge Firefly fan, did not get offered a job there, but then said to my agent, well, what about Star Trek? And the thing about the Star Trek shows is that they were very eclectic about how they hired people. And so my agent was very aggressive of trying to get Brannon on the phone to see if he was interested in meeting me. And at the time, Brannon had been interested in a writer named, I actually don't remember exactly which one it was. It was somebody who eventually ended up on Firefly. But Brannon had been interested in him for Enterprise and had been somewhat upset that he'd lost him to Firefly. And so my agent, knowing this, says to Brannon, you should meet David Goodman. He just met on Firefly. Joss is thinking about hiring him, which wasn't exactly a lie, but it wasn't, ended up not being the truth either. And Brannon, wanting to try and get even with Joss, said, well, get David Goodman in here. I want to meet him. So I got this meeting with Brannon because he thought he was potentially stealing somebody from Joss. And then in the meeting with Brannon, I've been, again, a huge Star Trek fan, and I've been reading interviews with Brannon at that point for 10 years and knew how he felt about Star Trek and knew what he would say about Star Trek. And so basically just sort of parroted a lot of things that I had read him in interviews say, and then talked about my favorite episodes of the first season of Enterprise, leaving out the ones that I didn't think were very good. But I thought there were some really good episodes. And I think Brannon had a very strong positive reaction because, one, he was hearing a lot of things that he himself would say because he had already said them. But then also I was picking episodes from the first season that he also thought were his strongest work. So, he and Rick had this idea of Enterprise being a lighter Star Trek, and they thought, oh, maybe it'll be fun to have a comedy writer on the staff. So that also sort of played a role in me getting the job. And I had the meeting with Rick, and I had had a writing sample that was a science fiction movie that they had read, they liked, and I was hired. Long story.
No, that's fascinating to see how all that works together, especially with the different shows and how everybody's just kind of looking for the right writer for their show. And that's excellent. What was it like then kind of getting to work behind the scenes and writing the different episodes that you got to work on and just kind of working, you know, in the world of Star Trek day in and day out?
Yeah, very exciting. You know, I don't know that I ever had a job where I felt like the ideas came easier. I think that the franchise was a little tired at that point. I think that Brannon and Rick would even admit to being tired in that they had been doing this type of show for a very long time. And so that if some of the storytelling lacked some freshness, on the other hand, they still did a great show. And I got to, you know, I got off to a rough start. The first episode I wrote was a show called Precious Cargo, which I still have never watched all the way through. I really did not come out well.
I want to let you know that I love that episode. I think it's hilarious.
Oh, okay, good. Then I won't. So, I won't try too hard.
I'm one of those
maybe
fans.
Maybe I'll watch it though.
Yeah, I think it's very funny. So, but I was always a huge Trip Tucker fan. So, thank you for that episode.
Oh, you're welcome. I would say that the the piece of crap that I wrote is not the piece of crap that aired, but I didn't watch it. So. It was heavily rewritten, but I had a lot of ideas in there. And again, Connor, I thought was a terrific actor. I think he did great work in other shows that I wrote, but it was, I almost got fired after that script. They really didn't think I fit in terms of a writer on that show. And I realized that pretty quickly that I had to get back to what it was that I loved about Star Trek and figure out what I wanted to write. And there had been this story that had been kicked around that another writer named Taylor Elmore had pitched that I took and reworked and repitched to Brannon, involving a Klingon and Archer being on trial and a flashback episode. And it was very funny because I didn't notice it at the time, but it had a very similar format to my Futurama episode, which was a trial episode where a lot of it's in flashback. And it was very funny that that was also my first episode of Star Trek had that same format. That became Judgment, and that kind of turned my prospects around at Star Trek. They changed their mind about me and thought I was worth keeping. And that really was writing something that I wanted to write. And, I'm very proud of that episode. I felt like the episode said something about not just about the Klingons, but also sort of about our society and our focus on war and how that affects us and affects our kids, and that you know, the Klingons are sort of standing in for our world in a certain way, and then also sort of got to set up some continuity issues about why. You know, why the Klingons of the original series are different than the Klingons of Next Gen, and I'm sort of setting a lot of that up in that Enterprise episode. So that was a lot of fun, and also getting to work with, I remember one of my first days, Brannon took me down to the set, and he said, oh, this is Herman Zimmerman, and I couldn't sort of, Herman Zimmerman is the production designer, and he's the name I've been seeing on the credits for years, and I just had this kind of like, oh, wow, reaction. And the two of them sort of laughed at me because I was still this fan getting to meet. And those behind-the-scenes people, I was still always very impressed to meet. And I think they all did amazing work week to week. I miss the fact that that kind of work isn't really being done on TV that way now. So that first season was, you know, those two episodes. And I was then brought back for a second season and working with some great people, Chris Black and Mike Sussman and Andre Bormanis, we're all still my friends and all still huge Star Trek fans, and sort of getting to infuse this show with Star Trek fan things was fun, and just ideas that I've had that made it into the show. And
I was going to ask, you know, you got to be on season 2 and then work on season 3, and season 3 has a big shift in it, kind of the push forward of Enterprise and really bringing the story forward and the characters forward and doing something that Star Trek had never done. Can you talk a little bit just about that shift and, you know, what you thought was kind of successful in that season, what maybe wasn't so successful, and just what it meant for kind of Enterprise overall.
Yeah, well, season three, I mean, I think that between season two and season three, I think the network was worried about the ratings. And Rick and Brannon came up with this idea of doing something, you know, really big in season three, a continuing story, and sending us to a new weird area of space. And, you know, so they were really trying to get the network on board for something really different and exciting. And I think that in the pitch stage, it was very exciting. And I think that there's still stuff about the Zindi arc that I think is really cool. I think that the idea of the Zindi planet, these five different species and two of them being completely computer generated, is something, again, you really don't see on television. And they were weird and it was fun. And I think that some of those episodes are great. I think what didn't work, and this actually leads back to when we talk about the book, was as the writing staff, we didn't fully plot it out ahead of time. So we're doing sort of weird, mysterious things that don't really fully tie together in a coherent fashion by the end of the season. And the backstory of the Zindi and the backstory of the Sphere Builders is very mysterious and weird, but you can't explain it. There's no explanation for it, and I personally, as a fan, I want that explanation. I want to know that it makes sense. And the Zindi backstory and what happened with the Sphere Builders, that backstory is just not clear. And
yeah, that's for me too. When you got to the Sphere Builders, I felt like I thought the Sphere Builder angle was cool, but it felt like a mystery that was kind of thrown out there and then left. I would have loved to have known more about that.
I agree. And so I think that's really where we failed as a writing staff. And I take some responsibility. I was involved in that. I mean, but I wasn't in charge, so I don't take full responsibility. Ironically, the beginning of that season, they had this pitch for the full season arc, but Rick had said, but make sure we break some freestanding episodes just in case we want to abandon it early on. So I was the only person on the writing staff who pitched a freestanding episode that season. It was North Star, the cowboy episode. And it was a very gratifying experience because I'm a fan of the original series, and there hadn't really been any parallel planet episodes in the sequel series. And I wanted to do a parallel planet episode, you know, like they had on the original series, like, you know, Rome or Omega Glory, or, you know, Bryn Circuses or Omega Glory or these things. And I pitched the premise of a kidnapped wagon train is transplanted on another planet. And I got to write that one, and its execution I thought was amazing. And again, Connor is amazing in it, and Scott is amazing. And, you know, it's a fun episode, and really great to see the parallel planet episode produced in modern television with the costumes of modern television and the cinematography. What did you guys like to think about that one?
I think you're right. I loved the look of that episode. It was a really well shot episode. Right. Just the way the camera angles happened, the way that it was lit as an episode, I thought was really good. And I thought it was really nice too to be able to have the crew have a couple of episodes that weren't about this whole big arc. In the same way that, you know, Deep Space Nine would take some breaks from the Dominion War and give you some just lighter episodes, which, you know, like Take Me Out to the Ballpark or something.
So I really
enjoyed that.
Well, thanks. I wasn't just looking for compliments. If you didn't like it, you should tell me.
It's a fun episode.
I think that the example of Deep Space Nine is an excellent one, because there they did, you know, two seasons of a war, or maybe it's almost three, and it was so well laid out, beautifully laid out as a fan, so satisfying. And the twists and turns with Gul Dukat and all those things, and that's something we didn't do well enough on Enterprise with our Zindi story. And having said that, there were some great episodes that season. I think Similitude holds up as a great Star Trek episode for any of the series, or Twilight, a great episode. Just great. There are some great, great episodes in that season.
Yes, I agree. There are some episodes in there that, you know, every time I watch, I find kind of gut wrenching. I think of Damages, good stuff. I think, did it seem like having kind of being under the gun from the studio didn't necessarily help you guys in the writing room?
Well, I don't know. I mean, at once they got the sign off, then it's really, again, it's all up to Rick and Brennan. And I think that the network laid off once the production started. I think that, you know, I think that there were always, you know, I think Enterprise, there was a lot that was great about it, and there was a lot that wasn't. And because of the premise of this is me as a Star Trek fan, the premise of the first ship is, I'm not sure that sending it alone into a space, you know, I always had the trouble of, why doesn't Zindi just blow up the Enterprise? Like, I'm not sure that I buy that Enterprise is on its own there and surviving. Whereas when you, the original series, you had a fleet. You know, there was a fleet. It was always, it wasn't just one ship. And so that the problems with the Zindi arc to me, you know, and Enterprise was, it's out there alone, but it's not alone. And there were just problems with the way we wrote stories based on how they'd been doing shows, that they needed to break the mold a little bit, and it wasn't broken enough to. And Brannon has told me about how they in concept they actually wanted the first season of Enterprise to take place on Earth, and building the ship, and then launching the ship, and then having that be really a process, which and that the network really wanted the Star Trek format, and I think that hurt the premise of this show, of the first ship, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so. I think that would have, you know, I heard that from Brannon as well, and I think that would have made a very excellent show. Definitely breaking with the mold a little bit from Star Trek, but giving us something completely new, something for people to really gravitate towards, because they'd never seen it before, and so you kind of want to keep watching, because you don't know, okay, when are they going to actually get to the... When are they going to get space? When is this ship going to be done? How's this all going to come together? I think that would have been really interesting.
I think so too. But anyway, so I don't know about being under the gun. I think that there were just problems in sort of in the, excuse the expression, problems in the bones of Enterprise that kept it from really fulfilling what it needed to as a Star Trek series. We got to write some great stuff and some great sequences. And there's the unusual crossover of Star Trek and Family Guy happened in third season when I brought Seth MacFarlane, who created Family Guy, in to play a role. He's a huge Star Trek fan, and plays an engineer in The Forgotten. And then he was brought back after I left in season four. And I love having that on my resume. The guy who plays Peter Griffin is on Family Guy.
That's great.
Is on Star Trek.
Well, you talked a little bit just about the genesis of Federation, the first 150 years, that CBS had approached you to do this book. Yeah. Walk me through just kind of that process and getting started, because that's a lot of ground to cover too, 150 years. And so,
Actually the book covers more like 250 years, because it's about here's how that all happened. So they had the idea of doing this book, and they sat down and asked me if I was interested, and I honestly didn't even know. And they wanted to have the sort of historical document in it. That was their idea, was that do the history book with sort of pieces of the historical documents in the book, just like this, sort of modeled on this book that was done about the American Revolution, that was a history of the American Revolution, 1776 is the name of the book. And there's a coffee table version of the book that has copies of the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And that was sort of the model of it. But that's all they had was that idea. And so it was then up to me to sort of write an outline, which they would then try to sell to a publisher. And it was a very sort of thin outline. It was only a couple of pages, but what would each chapter would cover, what period of history each chapter would cover, and what documents I would imagine would be in that chapter. And so I'm really making up these documents and I'm making up. And so I'm sort of, at that point, arbitrarily sort of deciding on periods, periods of time based, really using the Okuda's Star Trek chronology book, which was very helpful in terms of, they've done obviously all this work figuring out dates, and then figuring out from online resources what the dating is of the Enterprise episodes. And so figuring out that. And so I had that outline, and I did that and sort of made a pass at sort of figuring out ideas for documents. And I knew that I wanted some bit of the Articles of Federation in there, and that I wanted references to certain episodes, so sort of thinking of treaties and things like that from original series episodes and Enterprise episodes that I might reference in there, or biographies. So I wrote that, and that was in, let's say, June of... What year is it now? It's 2013. So this is June of 2011. And then I sent that in, and a few months later, I get a call from CBS. Okay, we sold it. You have 3 months to write this book.
Oh, goodness.
3 months. Go.
3 months. Go. And so then I'm talking to my editor, who worked at this book type, Jerry Becker Mayer, and we're sort of figuring out the book together. And the idea of the 150 years was the CBS Consumer Products, the man who worked there named John Van Sitters, huge Star Trek fan, said, you know, he had said that he wanted the history to cover from Zefram Cochran to Star Trek VI, that history would be the confines of it. And so the question that the editor and I had was figuring out, well, why? Who wrote the history? Who wrote the history book? Do I have John Gill write it? And then it didn't quite work because he can't cover, obviously, events past a certain point. And, do we have a fictional editor? You know, and then I decided I would be the, in-world historian. And that the idea was figuring out based on when the Federation was purportedly founded, that 150-year anniversary of the Federation would sort of adequately cover that period of time, and you could then sell the idea that this book was written as to celebrate the 150th anniversary. It was commissioned by Memory Alpha to celebrate the 150th anniversary. So this is sort of the in-world fiction that we came up with, the editor and I came up with as we're talking about the book, to sort of explain who is writing it and why. And that added a level to the book that I think was great. That added this level to the book that, again, puts it in the world of Star Trek. It's not just, it puts it in the timeline itself. It puts myself in the timeline. And I paid that off in the book in a couple of ways. So that 150th anniversary is like ends up on 2311, which is past the events of Star Trek VI, past Kirk's death on the Enterprise B, and covers, that territory. But then really sort of then sitting down, I had to sort of, with each chapter, figure out what in each chapter has already been covered. So in the first chapter, which was this prologue, it was Zefram Cochran and the meeting with the Vulcans. That's been covered, so I know I've got to explain that. And I've got to talk about World War III in some way. And I've got to cover things that were mentioned in Enterprise, which were like the episode Terra Nova, which talked about the Conestoga. I had to talk about that. And I had to talk about boomers, and I had to talk about cargo ships, and then I had to talk about the Valiant that was lost outside the galaxy, and I had to talk, there's all that was from original series, and I had to talk, there were a couple of things that I left out that haven't mentioned, like in Voyager, Friendship One, I didn't mention that. But so there were things that I didn't mention that were part of that history. And then other things that, I would sort of lay in preparation for things later in the book. So Jonathan Archer meeting Zefram Cochrane, for instance, which is a no. It's mentioned, I think, that he met Zefram Cochrane in Enterprise, but it doesn't say how. And so so that's my first chapter, and then I've got to write a cogent kind of history. And my first pass of the chapter really was just kind of this summary, which I turned into my editor, whose response was, "This reads like a Wikipedia entry," which was not a compliment, and really hurt. But she sort of pointed out that there was a couple times where I had quoted John Gill or somebody, and she said, "Why don't you do more of that?" And that really changed the book, because then whenever I sort of hit a snag, or I would like quote a fake book or a fake document or a fake piece of a fake interview. And that really sort of pulled the book together for me when I was writing it, was that I could really create these sort of off-screen characters or use people who were already in the canon to help me tell the story. But it was tough. It was tough to make sense of it all. It was tough to make sense of World War III. I don't know if you guys caught my footnote that explained why we've never heard of Khan on our Earth.
I did. Yeah, I did catch that. Why don't you let the listeners know, though, what you had done? Because I really liked that.
There was a bit of an argument for me with CBS, because I was just going to ignore the 1990s. Because we lived through the 1990s, and I wanted this to feel like it may be a real history book. And, I never met, Khan didn't rule a quarter of my world. But CBS was insistent. I had to mention it. I had to figure it out. And, so somebody sets a goal like that for you, it's a challenge to overcome it in a way that you're satisfied. And what I came up with was this idea. So I talk about the 1990s and the genetic Superman and who they were, and this was actually a chance to include some names that had been mentioned in original series episodes, like Ferris and Maltubus, Lee Kwan, and these were all sort of parts. These guys ended up all being part of the World War III, and who they were as part of that. But I mentioned the 1990s, and then in a footnote, I sort of mentioned that World War III was such a catastrophic event. So many people had when time travel was discovered, people tried to go back and change it. And one group tried by stealing a ship. We don't know if they were successful. If they were successful, it was only in creating an alternate timeline, implying, of course, that you and I are living in an alternate timeline, that there is no eugenics wars, there is no World War III, which I liked. I feel like, now both worlds can exist. In the Star Trek world, Star Trek exists in an alternate timeline. And that was exciting to sort of figure that out. And to have that on the first page, I think, sets a tone for the book, a fun tone for the book.
Yes, that's the thing I really liked and responded to when reading this, is that it feels like I've walked into any, future bookstore. And if they still have bookstores then, which I would hope that
exactly.
They would in some form, and that this was sitting there and I just picked it up and I'm perusing it and I'm getting to look back at the history just as I would, like you said, the 1776 book and
right.
Seeing the different things. And this is just my history. And I think it really, really works. Where do all the sources come from? Because there's a lot of things in here. Did you just make the things up, or?
Yeah, completely. I know that I used John Gill a couple of times because that's an original series historian, and then there's another historian from the animated series that I used once to talk about the Klingons, and I thought it's an alien historian that I thought was. Only an alien historian could do history of the Klingons, like a human historian really couldn't do a history of the Klingons. So I wanted that historian to be alien, and I referenced an animated series character. And then there are names, you know, I drew names from people who I knew, or names of people who were mentioned on the show, and tried to mix it up, tried to make it histories, tried to make it transcripts, tried to make it diaries, biographies, so that it wasn't always quoting a history or quoting, you know, and there was a point where I kind of hit a wall, where I was sort of run out of a variety of things. It's like, okay, I've done a lot of biographies, quoting biographies of people, quoting histories. And so there was, I came up with this, Commodore Mendez, the character Commodore Mendez, which is an original series character, is discussing the Battle of Donatoo 5, where he fought with Matt Decker. And I said he related in an interview with this author, implying that I had interviewed him, which I, at that moment at 4 a.m. when I was writing that chapter, I was very pleased when I came up with that, that idea that I'm really placing myself in the book. And I did that another time with, I think, Hiram Roth, who's the name of the name I took from some website for the president of the Federation in Star Trek 4.
That's what we call living Star Trek.
Yes,
exactly. We hashtag
right.
That on Twitter all the time.
So those were all things I made up to give it kind of a life, that there had been all these other histories written or other things written that had contributed to this book.
So when it comes to then, you know, the literary universe that it exists in the novels, that isn't something that you really used at all then?
I didn't, I read a lot of the books and there were things that I liked. So there are things that sort of snuck in. So for instance, that reference the reference in the footnote that I'm talking about the Eugenics Wars, I don't know that Michael Jan Friedman would get that I was referencing Crossover, his book, but I have them steal the USS Yorktown from the Starfleet Museum to go back in time, and that's a reference to Scotty stealing it. I like that book, and I enjoyed it. So there are things like that where I would take something that I would like. There may have been, you know, and I'm sort of blanking. I feel like there was another reference in a book that I had read. Well, certainly, honestly, I think it's at First Frontier. Is that the Diane Carey book about Robert April? There's a book Diane Carey wrote about Robert April and George Kirk on the Enterprise, on the first Enterprise, and it definitely inspired part of the chapter, the creation of the Robert April character in my book, because I thought I enjoyed the characterization of April in that book. But those are sort of really the only things. I didn't, not in any way, it's impossible to adhere to the continuity of the novels and the continuity of the series, I think. And then on top of it, just, again, I enjoy the novels, the ones that I read. They're required to put our characters at the center of history. And what I wanted to do with this book was, whenever possible, say there was plenty of history going on without our characters, without the main characters of the series, so that you had a sense of an epic scope of history, other things were going on, and Kirk isn't always at the center of everything.
Right, which is very nice. I sometimes feel that our main characters are overused, and
right.
Especially happens in literature, so I'm glad that you took that approach.
Thank you.
Well, and you also got the opportunity to do something like put Curzon Dax inside the background of Star Trek VI,
right.
Which I thought was excellent because it made a lot of sense, especially with that character and what we know of Curzon. And I was really excited to see stuff like that in this book. That just made it so much fun as a fan. I felt like I was watching the behind the scenes of Star Trek, you know, history. And that's what really makes this book worth the buy and very exciting. And so,
Well, thank you very much. You know, honestly, that was putting Curzon in that chapter was really hard. because I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Deep Space Nine. I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of the character of Curzon Dax. Never quite understood it. I never quite got it. Because you never fully get to see that character realized by an actor. So there's a way in which it was always this weird off-screen character. He existed inside Dax. So for me as a fan, I had a lot of trouble picturing that character. So to put him in Star Trek VI, but it was necessary. CBS is actually, CBS had mentioned Curzon. I would make sure to include Curzon. And I realized, oh, right, he would have been a big part of this in some way. He had to be. And it was hard. It was really hard because those characters in Star Trek VI, I've seen that movie, you know, 30 times. And putting him in the background there was really difficult in a way that I felt like made sense. So I'm really glad you enjoyed that thing.
Yeah, it's my favorites of the Star Trek films. And so just to get more background on it, I will appreciate the film all the more now for reading this. And so,
oh, very cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you
no,
very much.
I love that movie. I love that movie. I think it's a great movie.
Well, one of the things that I really liked was you kind of helped to answer some of the questions about Federation and Earth's leadership, and kind of Earth always being at the center of the Federation. Talk to me just about that kind of idea and what you'd come up with in the book.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's interesting because I think that in the development, you can sort of see it in the original series that when you watch it, is that over time, the Federation in the original series, I think it was a creative evolvement on the series, is that Earth was at the center of it in the beginning, in the first season. You got the United Earth Space Probe Agency is the authority that runs Starfleet, and everything's really kind of Earth. And when you talk about the Earth-Romulan War, it's the Earth-Romulan War. It wasn't the Federation-Romulan War. And, you know, it was all these things, the Earth-centric things. I think that was a function of the writers, Roddenberry and the writers, sort of taking baby steps to this, to the larger idea of a Federation made up of aliens, made up of this sort of democratic government that's not just humans. Because as the series progresses, the show is much less Earth-centric. You really do get the sense. Journey to Babel, great example in second season of like,
right.
It is not Earth centric. You got a bunch of aliens. We got to worry about all these aliens, and it's not Earth's show anymore. And I think that was a creative evolvement on the show. It got like a confidence that happened among the writers. Like it doesn't have to be Earth centric. It could be more of a you know, different aliens kind of thing. But approaching this book, that's my guess as to what happened. But if you watch the episode, you can't get away from the fact that in that first season of the original series, it's Earth centric. And that then also a step further with Enterprise was a very Earth centric show. And one of the things I did contribute to Enterprise was this idea, and it's in a lot of episodes, it's in Ceasefire, which although I didn't write the episode, I worked on it with Chris Black, and I played a role in saying this is why, and this wasn't intended, I don't think, when they started with Enterprise to fill in the Federation, is that this is why Earth matters. Earth is going to bring these aliens who do nothing but fight together, and that to me was, as a Star Trek fan, that at working on Enterprise back then, I felt like I was really making a contribution to the idea of connecting Enterprise to the original series. Why is the Federation so Earth-centric? So I actually did play a role in that, which I kind of am very proud of. And so that had to be my approach in the book, which is rather than ignore the fact that these shows were Earth-centric, say that there is something unique about humans moving out into the galaxy, that they brought something to the party that brought people together, brought these alien races together, and that Earth and Vulcan especially is the core of this, that partnership, and sort of showing the events in the book that brought those two planets to a place where, from Enterprise, where they're allies, but tense allies, to the fact that to the original series where Earth and Vulcan are, you know, of the same mind, that these are just straight-ahead allies who support each other and are, you know, and that showing that involvement, I think, was kind of exciting, and that the Romulan War had something to do with that, and that what happened in the Romulan War and the specifics of what I came up with informed that change.
Yes, definitely. I think that was one of my favorite parts of the book. I thought it worked very well to see that, you know, because of what humanity had been through, that it was able to help these other species in the galaxy see things from a different perspective, you know, because humans have just been through war. Many of these species don't know war on their own planets for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And so Earth has a different perspective on violence now than even Vulcans or, say, Andorians, Tellarites.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting because, in the sense, that's just how we as humans are, too. We learn from our experiences, hopefully, you know, and it was neat to see that does have a play in the galaxy. And so,
I put those words in John Gill's mouth in my book, sort of giving credit to John Gill for something that I thought of, but I like that idea. I like that idea that that because we got out into space right after this horrific World War III, we were going to be skittish about starting wars and getting into fights and figure we were going to make an extra effort for peace. And that to me was, at least explained that, you know, why humans made a difference.
One of the things I was kind of wondering while reading the book, and especially knowing that CBS approached you to do this, the canon question, you know, where does this book rank, do you think, in that kind of, in those kind of terms?
Well, I was told that this book is canon until somebody films something that says it's not. That the CBS felt very, you know, and they knew that I would be slavish to continuity, so that that was part of the sales of it. This is put out now by, you know, the official Star Trek producer, and saying, and that this is canon, and that was my job, was to make it feel like canon, make it feel like it didn't contradict filmed adventures of Star Trek. Star Trek is film. I mean, it's TV or it's movies, and so that to me is always, and that's always going to be canon. You always have to say, this is canon. Now, obviously, it's canon for the Prime Universe, because JJ's universe is different. Is an alternate universe. So this is Prime. This is canon for what fans call the Prime Universe.
Well, and there is that nice, you know, you do that a little bit with the JJ universe, saying that, you know, even in the Prime Universe, Kirk is born on the Kelvin.
The Kelvin.
And
yeah.
So you pay homage to that. And I thought that was really nice to see, you know, obviously without following the rest of what happened there. So
right.
Really cool.
I, you know, honestly, I felt like that was cool. I felt like it's interesting because I'd read on a website that one of the writers of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, Roberto Orci, had said, in their minds, you know, the Kelvin, in the regular universe, the Kelvin would have made it back to Earth before she gave birth, or, you know, and that Kirk would have been born on Earth. My feeling was, since they didn't explain that, my feeling was it was cooler that Kirk, although raised in Iowa, was born in space, the child of two Starfleet officers. I just think that's cooler for his character. So I was happy to sort of embrace that.
Well, are there any plans at all, for a sequel to this? Because I'd love to see, you know, from Star Trek VI up to, say, the days of Picard and onward.
Well, I mean, I imagine it determines on how much money this book makes will determine whether there's a sequel. So that's the question.
So everyone go out right now and buy this book. Buy two copies. We want that TNG future.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's all about how it sells. I mean, I think it's doing pretty well. It's only available on Amazon, so it limits, you know, its sales possibilities. But The reaction has been very good. What can I ask you guys? Do you have anything you didn't like about the book? I'd love to hear some criticisms.
You know, there were just parts that I wish that had gotten more fleshed out. I think the only thing that I really wanted a little bit more of was seeing some of the background for Kirk between, you know, the 5-year mission and him becoming an admiral and all those kind of things. There's that section that's really short in the book. I think that's the only thing I would have wanted more in. Because that's definitely an area we don't know a lot about at all.
No, we don't.
And so I think that if I could have added something, I would have wanted something there.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I think that, you know, we were limited in space. And again, that piece of it isn't necessary because I wasn't actually covering history. I was covering history. So unless those events played in the larger historical context, I don't know that. And since they didn't exist, I didn't see a need to make them up. So. Although maybe it would be a chance to do to sneak phase two into there, sneak the aborted phase two series. So not the fan series, but the one that was going to be produced for.
Right.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of kind of the in-between stuff that goes on there and,
yeah.
Even just the change in, Starfleet ships from the, old Constitution class and seeing, when we get to the films, the ships look very different. And seeing that change in Starfleet and Starship engineering. So, but yeah, honestly, you're right. There's, you want to keep the book to a certain length. And I think reading through it, it really is a great length. You can sit down and read it in a couple sittings. It's excellent for that. And it looks great around the house too. So.
Yeah. I have one on my table. I'm very, very proud of it.
So. Well, one of the things I always enjoy seeing writers and asking them is, what are the things that you yourself enjoy reading when you get a chance or, when you go to a Barnes & Noble or, any bookstore? What kind of piques your interest in?
Well, I read a lot of nonfiction. When I got hired to do this book, I was reading a book called Sea of Thunder, which is a book about the Battle of Leyte Gulf, which was a World War II battle.
Yes.
And it's a great book by Evan Thomas, and I was reading it at that moment, and it informed how I wrote the section on the Romulan War, because I love those sort of descriptions of historical descriptions of war, and so I read nonfiction, but I'm a big science fiction reader still. I'm just reading right now John Scalzi's book, Old Man's War, which is fun. The book I read before that was a nonfiction book about the 2008 election, Game Change. Great book. So I mix it up. Reading. I'm doing a television show right now. I'm writing for a television show that's a cop show, so I'm also reading cop mysteries right now. So I mix it up. I'm an eclectic reader. I probably don't read a lot of sort of literary fiction. That's probably the one area that I don't read a lot of. Definitely sort of historical nonfiction, which informed this book, obviously.
Who is your favorite science fiction author?
That's interesting. Interesting question. I was a big fan for a long time of Philip Jose Farmer, who wrote the River World series and wrote some really fun pastiches. He would sort of mix things up, and I don't know if you're aware this for the Star Trek fans out there. He wrote he pitched to Star Trek, the original series. And two of his short stories he originally came up with for Star Trek episodes. So the two short stories are The Shadow of Space and Sketches Among the Ruins of My Mind. It's hard to figure out how Sketches Among the Ruins of My Mind could be a Star Trek episode, but The Shadow of Space, it's a weird story, but it takes place on a starship, and there's this weird thing that happens, and it's a very cool story. And as a Star Trek fan, it's fun to read you know, read a science fiction author who was also trying to write for Star Trek and took his unsold ideas and made them into short stories. That was kind of cool. But I've also read a lot of, you know, a lot of Isaac Asimov, a lot of Arthur C. Clarke, and a lot of Larry Niven. The Mote in God's Eye, if I had to pick a... The Mote in God's Eye is, to me, like the best science fiction novel it's almost like they wrote the best Star Trek episode ever. That book is a great book, and it has the feel of Star Trek in a certain way, but it's so much more, and it's a great book. So. Have you read that book? Have you guys read that book?
I haven't read that one, actually.
You should. Oh, The Mote in God's Eye. Go get it. It's great.
Actually, I believe I have the audio version of that, but I haven't been through it in a long time.
Yeah, it's quite good. It's quite a good book. Great science fiction.
Well, one of the last thing that we always like to do with the author is tell us what you're working on now and where people can follow you and find you. And this is your space to just talk about what you're doing and basically plug anything you'd like to.
Well, currently I sold a TV series to Fox. It's called Murder Police. It's an animated show. It's basically an animated cop show. It'll be on Fox on Sunday nights in November. So we're excited about that.
And, ooh, for some animation domination.
Yeah, there you go. And so I'm working on that right now. So I have most of my time. I hope to do another Star Trek type book, either a sequel to this or there's something else, which we haven't sold yet. So I'm not going to talk about it because we may not sell it, and then I'll feel bad that I mentioned it. You can follow me on Twitter, David A. Goodman on Twitter. But there's a lot of mostly write jokes on Twitter. if you don't like off color jokes, don't follow me on Twitter. I think that probably covers it right now. In May, I wrote a Lego Batman movie. The guys who do the Lego Batman video game had access to all the sort of computer program to create Gotham City, and we wrote a little straight-to-DVD movie that's a lot of fun and cute for kids. It's fun. So, and I'm very happy if you're a fan of that stuff. It's fun.
That's very cool.
I'm actually a huge fan of that, and because they've done the same thing with the Star Wars Lego, and they've been hilarious, and so I'm very actually excited. I've been watching and waiting for the Batman one to come out, so I'm excited to know that you were a part of it.
I wrote it. It's great. Have you seen that trailer online?
It's hilarious.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm very excited.
Great. It looks great. I think it'll be released in May.
Excellent. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on. I'm very thankful that CBS saw this idea and brought it to you, because I think it adds so much to Star Trek right now. There's been kind of a lack of this kind of thing for the Prime Universe for a long time. And Chris and I have even talked about, we would really love to have the episode guide and the behind the scenes guide for Enterprise, because there's been nothing like that.
Yeah.
I think that the market, unfortunately, the market for those kinds of books is really dried up. Like there used to be, because people are buying online and they don't sell those kinds of TV books anymore, and because so much of that information is available online. I mean, you know, when Mark Zakrie wrote the Twilight Zone Companion, which was one of the first TV books, there was no way to get any of that information about the Twilight Zone. You know, the way he did that episode guide really, I think, almost created a genre of book. And, the Star Trek books that came out then, unfortunately, the internet kind of makes those books not as profitable as they used to be.
Be sure to go and bug CBS about these Enterprise Blu-rays and have them bring you in to do some creative commentaries.
Oh, they did. Thank you. No, I don't know that I did. I didn't do any commentary, but they definitely interviewed me for them, and I think they'll be good. Yeah, they didn't use me on the commentaries for the originals, but
okay. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, David. We really appreciate your time. And of course, everybody, go out and buy Federation First 150 Years from Amazon. So just pull that up and get a copy of that. You will not be sorry.
Yeah, go grab that, because David, we really hope that we'll be able to see the future beyond, you know, the Undiscovered Country and into the up to date now in a second book. So I hope people pick this up.
Well, thank you guys. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, Matthew, that was a wonderful opportunity to talk to David about not only this book, which is a fantastic piece of creative work, but also all that background information on Enterprise was brilliant. You know, you and I both love Enterprise. I don't care if some people don't like that show. I love it. And it was really interesting to hear some of the behind the scenes there.
Well, I mean, definitely. And Chris, as we learned in that interview, not only do I love Enterprise, but I love Precious Cargo. So take that, people who don't like Precious Cargo, because it's funny and I like it.
Well, as Picard says in the closing of our show every week, to each his own, Matthew. So there you go. Let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on today's show, any of the news, their thoughts on Federation or Enterprise. If you want to talk about that as well, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. That message will come directly to myself and to Matthew. You can find us on Facebook, where we have a very rapidly growing community, and that's at facebook.com/trekfm. And you can always find us over on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what if people want to find you on the interwebs?
Yes, well, of course, I'm all over Trek FM with the book reviews, reading through a new book right now by David R. George III, so that'll be coming out soon. And then, of course, you can also find me on the Twitter, MattRushing02, trying to tweet there about things like Star Trek and sports ball and all those kind of interesting things going on in my life. Or maybe not so interesting things. So it's up to you. But I hope you will follow me. Give me an at reply. Let me know you're following me. And we'll enjoy talking things like Star Trek or Enterprise, Deep Space Nine. In fact, any of the series.
Absolutely. Give Matthew a follow there. And if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in the social media world under that username. And I'm always tweeting about Star Trek, of course, sometimes about my personal life with the Star Trek twist, sometimes photos of Kirk Bear getting into all kinds of shenanigans, and like Matthew, sports ball, Japan design, all kinds of things. So give me a follow over there. And while you're online, drop by trek.fm and check out some of our other shows. We have 11 shows on the network now, covering everything from general Star Trek discussion to series-specific shows. Matthew and I do The Orb together as well. That show is all about Deep Space Nine. We had a wonderful conversation this week about Benjamin Sisko as an emissary, an ambassador, and an apostle. And you can find all kinds of fascinating stuff there at trek.fm. And also, we want to thank everyone for leaving us ratings and reviews in iTunes. We really appreciate it. We love hearing from you, and it helps people find the show in the mysterious inner workings of the iTunes store.
Well, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, we'll say live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.